Hello and welcome to episode number 52 of Light the Eye, presented by the U of I Credit Union. I'm Scott Beatty.
And I'm Robert Rosenthal.
We're right here in our studio inside the Center for Teaching and Innovation and Learning in the Armory on the campus of the University of Illinois. And coming up on this episode, our first two-play of the year. Robert, in basketball, there's always that time when, for the first time, you're facing an opponent for the second time.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the question of the coach, well, how are you preparing for Northwestern the second time around? What's it like in your preparation? We get Josh Whitman for the second time on our podcast. How do you want to approach this one?
Thank you for resurrecting the entire program. Will you stay for 30 years? Is that too fanboy? That's a little too much.
So just a little while ago, Josh Whitman had his first media, no, not his first, his annual media roundtable with the assembled media. And he discusses in a more informal way the state of Illinois athletics. He looks back at the year that was. He looks forward to the year that's coming, updates us on a variety of topics. Some are very interesting to fans. Some are a little bit more mundane about the operations of athletics. And then, of course, there's always the national items going on in college sports, which there's no shortage of this year or any of the last several years. So we get to hear his thoughts on a variety of things. There's time for Q&A with him there, but then he kindly offers up some follow-up time with folks like us here on this podcast. So last time we visited with him, it was a little bit more talking about him reflecting on 10 years as the AD. This time it's a little bit more like, okay, we're at the end of an athletic year. 25-26 is closing. 26-27 is on the horizon. So we get to hear his thoughts on a variety of things.
Yes. You know what? I feel like before we talk about any of those things, we do have a duty we need to fulfill here.
What's that?
People have been watching and looking and saying, the eye is not lit. Somebody light that eye before it bothers me for the whole episode. So you think we should do that now?
Well, yeah, well, you should do that.
Okay, let's do that. Let's light the eye.
It occurs to me that we are sitting around a round table here in our studio. It's kind of an oval table, but the table we sat at with Josh Whitman was decidedly square.
Yes.
It was a bunch of rectangular tables shaped into a square. So it's a misnamed event that we were at.
You know, I believe that when Ron Gunther did these like 25 years ago, he had a big round table in his office. And I believe it was, I mean, then it was just like Lauren and other guys, you know, covering the team at the time. But I believe it did begin as an actual round table thing in the office where you got to like go in and see what the AD hanging on the wall.
Why do they call it a round table? Why don't they call it an oval table?
That's gold, Jerry.
It's gold.
Gold.
Before we discuss some of what we heard from Josh Whitman, and then of course he will be our guest here in a little bit, some highlights, if you will.
Let's do it.
Some highlights. Obviously the biggest story of the week. Not a surprise, but nonetheless, very celebratory. Keaton Wagler, number 5 in the NBA draft to the LA Clippers, one of the highest draft picks ever. Darren Williams went 3, right?
Yep.
And then Keaton Wagler went 5, and one of the Flying Illini went number
Kendall
5.
Gill went 5.
Yeah, Kendall
Gill went 5. Not the year after the Final Four. He came back that
yeah,
Anderson went 11 in the 89 draft.
Yeah.
And then he went 5 the next year.
And the only consensus freshman All-American in program history. I mean, the story is just an incredible one. And of course, the sound bites are out now. You get how an NBA team, a GM, and a head coach view their top draft pick. And so you hear all that they saw. Apparently, they came out and watched a fall practice. They were here to see other people on the Illini roster, and they said, we saw what we needed to see with Keaton Wagler.
Yeah, and it's going to be like the video that the Clippers put out. I don't know if you saw this yesterday. The video of him entering the facility, had school kids there all in Keaton Wogler shirts, like hundreds of school kids. All the signage around the arena is Wogler and all this stuff. And they, you know, they've already got all these shirts made. It's, again, I watch it like he's my nephew or something. Like, you know, oh my gosh, good for that kid, good for his family. It's just, I was taking videos of the TV screen when he was picked, just so I have it on my phone. Like, it means a lot for that kid, to, for what he did to bring this whole, you know, the centerpiece of this Final Four run and everything else, to see it, that all crowned with a number five pick, top five NBA draft pick. That's amazing.
It has to be a little bit daunting. He's realizing his dream, but he's still a teenager in a sense, and he's walking into a facility and he's soon going to be walking around with veterans of the NBA in their late 20s or early 30s or late 30s, whatever it is. And you have to figure out and go, I know I'm a good basketball player. Do I belong here? And he does. He does. And somebody, you know, expressed to me, well, gosh, I don't know if he's going to, you know, he's kind of a bit undersized and really, really make it in the NBA. And I'm like, I promise you, no team has any interest in paying a whole lot of money if they don't think there's going to be a high return.
Yeah, and a whole lot of money is like, this is a four-year, $44 million deal.
Yeah.
When you're 19. You know what I was doing in the June after my freshman year here? Do you know what I was doing? I was checking the mail every day at home because I was getting a letter that was putting me on academic probation after a terrible spring semester, and I didn't want my parents to find it. So I had seen my report card, and I was pretty sure I knew what that meant. So that was my age 19 June. And for his, it's signing a contract for somewhere around, that's the, you know, it's kind of slotted in the NBA. Yeah. Maybe it'll be a tiny bit more, a tiny bit less, but it's the whole scale, the first round is slotted. And for him, it's 4 years, $44 million.
And this week also, Ayo Dosunmu got a huge five-year deal.
$112 million.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. And you know, so now you're going to be able to follow the NBA, and you're going to be seeing Keaton Wogler out there, Terrence Shannon Jr., Ayo Dosunmu, Kasper Siakouchonis, who was traded to Milwaukee. Who am I missing?
There's Will Riley.
Oh, Will Riley, of course.
I was listening to the Bill Simmons podcast, but because I wanted to hear what he said about, he had House and the Ringer NBA guy on just to go through the draft, and I wanted to hear him talk about Keaton. And Joe House, the guy he has on, is a Wizards fan and was talking about what this team looks like with Devansa and how, like, maybe Will Riley is the scoring guard and this and that, like trying to put the pieces together for the Wizards and in a few years to be really good. And so it's just, here I am listening just to hear some stuff, and I hear them talking about Jakachonis and where he fits in Milwaukee, and then I hear him talking about Will Riley and the excitement from the Wizard fans of where he might fit with this new look roster they're putting together. It is a good time to be
online. I know you put out there, and it's worth folks just go ahead and check it out. Just for context, draft picks for Illinois basketball over the last so many years, and then the recent years, how there's just been this huge spike of first rounders. And I mean, last year there was two first rounders, and all the guys that we just mentioned, just in the post COVID Brad Underwood era.
Yep.
It's an incredible, the pipeline for Illinois basketball into the NBA is back.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I started with that list. I did the last 20 years, so I started with 07, and 06 was the last draft pick before that, D Brown going in the second round of the Jazz. And so, you know, what, one draft pick from 2007 to 2020, Myers Leonard in 2011, and that's it. And then now what? Three,
did Malcolm
four.
Hill get drafted?
He did not. I mean, he ended up, he played some minutes, yeah, in the NBA. Brandon Paul played some minutes with the Spurs. And
there's, you know, a couple of guys that kind of, you know, depending on how you want to classify them as Illini or not, you know, Kendrick Nunn.
Yeah.
You know, there's a bit of an arm's length there because of some history, but he was an Illini. You know, and then even in the Underwood era, Brandon Pajemski, mm-hmm, did not get drafted out of Illinois because, yep, he left. But still, I mean, He was a guy on the roster, you know. Yes. And then did Merez Johnson get drafted?
Yeah, number 9.
I stopped after watching after 5. But I mean, like, he was on the roster, you know.
The recruiting class for 2 years ago is Merez Johnson, number 9 pick. Will Riley, number 21 pick. Kasper Siakachonis, number 20 pick. Tomislav Ivicic, who's still here, could be picked next year. And Jason Jaksdis. Like Jason Jaksdis joined a recruiting class, possibly with 4 NFL draft picks, 3 of them in the first round. Underwood's ability to find this talent is quite amazing.
You said NFL, but you meant NBA.
Did I say NFL?
Yes.
It's almost like I have a football-shaped brain.
If we cut you open, out would just come the old pigskin.
Out comes this table. it's an oval.
Let's stay on basketball for a moment, because it also came out today during Josh Whitman's roundtable. Illinois basketball will play a neutral site game against UNC in Nashville. It will be in January 30th, 2027. So like Illinois playing Duke in Madison Square Garden in sort of a random feeling non-conference game in the midst of your conference schedule, Illinois is going to play a high power game against the Tar Heels in Nashville. Cue the James Augustine joke.
I'm leaving it alone. I won't talk about it. Only watched it once.
Can you suit him up?
Just put Sean May out there. Okay. Anyway, we're going to leave it alone. For those who love going to Illini basketball games away from the State Farm Center, and there's a crowd that goes to a lot of road games, I see them. This is a fantastic season. You're playing Texas Tech down there. You're playing Duke in Cameron Indoor. You're playing UConn in the United Center. You're playing North Carolina in a neutral site in Nashville, and Missouri in St. Louis. I mean, this is...
Yeah. Is there anything else? Maybe we'll get some more. I don't know.
I mean, usually once you have 5 like that, you're probably not... It's usually like 5 marquee games.
Yeah, but there's 32 games.
Oh, that's true. So. That's true. They could add one more. Who knows?
I don't know.
Why not play Kentucky at Kentucky or something? I mean, they're loading this thing up. They will not be hurting for strength of schedule points.
Yep. The final end of season awards came out. The Dyke Edelman Award winners were announced along with newcomers of the year and freshman of the year. No surprise on freshman of the year for the men, it's Keaton Wagler. And then he's also the Dyke Edelman Award winner.
Yep.
That goes to the top Illinois male athlete, the top female athlete, Sophia Beckman. I think we threw her out there in our Wonder Who, but I forgot to consider, she did win a national championship on the indoor side of the long jump.
What's that sport? What did she do?
Track and field?
Long jump?
And she well cleared 10 feet.
Long jump.
Yeah.
Something in my head.
Long jump.
I'm thinking
she probably practices that.
Yes.
And track had a quote down year on the women's side because they only took 8th in the country.
Yes. Yes. And what, 3rd at the indoor? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's kind of funny how these awards have gone. Illinois basketball swept them because newcomer went to Andre Stojakovic. So Illinois basketball took all 3 awards. And then did track take all 3?
Yeah, because, at least freshman went to a woman.
Yeah, who was newcomer? I don't know if I looked that up.
I did.
Newcomer, I think it was track. I think it was a sweep for
Gerald.
There you go. So a sweep for track and a sweep for men's basketball in those awards. For years, volleyball really dominated that category for a while. For the women's, men's, I think, you know, if you win an individual national championship, like say, you know, we've seen it for wrestling, we've seen it for gymnastics, this and that. Final Four run gave Illinois basketball all 3 awards.
And then some facility news that just came out from Josh Whitman today at his round table. Something I'm particularly excited about. A renovation coming for Illinois Field. That's the baseball stadium in Champaign. A $5 million anonymous gift. Wasn't me. Was it you?
Wasn't me.
Was it Kendall?
No. Okay.
Because if it was me, it would involve a press box renovation. But this does not involve a press box. But I am very happy because it's this is a fan-centric renovation, but also will help the team. New seat backs and additional seats going down the first and third base lines. Permanent seat backs, unlike the temporary ones that they used when they hosted the regional. New and expanded dugouts, and I think there will be some bathroom facilities in there and then storage space and some other tech upgrades. But that seating bowl is now going to be a lot more comfortable than just the bleacher style seating. And I'll tell you what, even without the seat backs, a nice weather day, people show up. Mm-hmm. It's easy to get 1,000 plus there at Illinois Field. So I'm just thrilled. This has been a long time coming, and it is expected to be completed. There's not a specific date, but the expected completion is spring of 2027, which would mean, you know, next season. And the first known home game would be mid-March. Sometimes there's some Tuesday night games that come a little bit earlier in March or late February, depending on the whole schedule, how that gets set. But I'm just thrilled for this and very thankful as part of the baseball program for whoever made that gift.
The request you put in for the Game of Thrones style throne for the play-by-play guy, mm-hmm. did that go through? Or
it's going to be phase two.
Oh, that's phase two.
This is step one here.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So nothing for you in this whole thing.
Yeah, no, but what can I say? I'm about the fans.
That's right. That's right.
That's what I'm all about. Also, the U of I is exploring options for a joint practice facility for volleyball and wrestling. This would not be a new competition venue. That, for now, is going to remain Huff Hall. This is all what Josh Whitman explained to us, but a new facility at a location to be determined, with a look that's to be determined. They're talking to architects. And you know, when you start talking to architects, you can go any direction.
That's right. They just want to put pretty pictures on that make no sense. It's a shift from wrestling get its own facility, and then that was taken off the boards, and now a practice facility for both the programs that use Huff.
Maybe you just put the new facility right where Lot 31 is.
Let's not do that. It is untouchable.
There's a lot of open space there.
It's only the greatest tailgating lot in all of college football right next to the stadium. So let's not do that. Let's put it.
I'm trying to think of the athletes.
We could put it.
What did I just say? I'm all about the athletes.
Let's put it next to, I call it Impey. People now call it the Arc. There's that parking lot. Let's get rid of that parking lot just north of Grange Grove. We can put it there.
We seem to be good at getting rid of parking lots.
That's right.
You know what? That parking lot,
mm-hmm.
1998, that's where the Marching Illini practiced.
Mm.
And then they said, you know what? We're going to make a parking lot. So we moved into what is Grange Grove.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was a grass parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the Marching Illini then got moved out of there. This is after I was in the band. They got moved to... it was along 4th Street by Huff Hall in an area that was sometimes a parking lot.
Hmm. And then that became the Arts and Design.
The Siebel Center and all that. Now the Marching Illini
got a permanent spot.
Yeah, a turf. It's a permanent, and they got their own tower, and it's great.
Yes.
But wherever the marching band went, it tended to become
a parking lot.
Something
paved paradise.
Back in my day.
Yes.
All right, here endeth our, unless you have anything else under for highlights, that's our highlights segments. We talked with Josh Whitman. He actually talked with us by and large. But we're going to invite him in here in just a moment. But any themes or items that stood out to you?
The biggest thing is his opening of his opening statement this year was less like, statistics, like it has been the last few years. And he even said this. He's like, I'm not going to do as many numbers here. I'm going to talk more broad as to the. And he based it on the Final Four, of how that's such an accomplishment, not just for the basketball program, but for the athletic department. And, you know, he talked about how 14 million people watched the UConn Illinois game in the Final Four, and that's 14 million people hearing the name of the university. And he talked about the campus and how it's brought notoriety and how athletics have, you know, brought eyeballs onto universities in this age where recruiting for universities and students is so high and everything else. And he just talked about how this was like really a moment. Look, I was over there like ready to pump my fist as the fan in the room, but it was a great kind of shift from how he's done. Like, here's the statistics of how things are going. This was, here's the big picture of how things are going and where we stand after reaching this kind of pinnacle moment in college athletics.
I think it dovetails into one of my takeaways with it is when it comes to college athletics, there's a lot of chaos right now, and it's been in a tumultuous time for several years. But it seems like Illinois's got a ship that is able to weather the rough seas here with a lot of stability. Look, Josh Whitman just celebrated his 10th anniversary as the athletic director, but he also had a longtime chancellor in there and a longtime president in Tim Killeen, who is going to be exiting after this year. That's been announced. So you contrast that with some schools that have drawn some prominent attention lately for a high turnover rate with athletic directors or presidents or whatever. You have this stability, and I don't think anybody would say we're just satisfied or we're kind of there. But football and men's and women's basketball are in really good spaces, and those are the highest profile sports. And I feel like they are set to have some sustained success if they keep doing the right things the right way, et cetera, et cetera. So now you have an athletic director who can be highly participatory in the Division I council at the NCAA level and active in these big national issues. And then some coaching changes and some other things can start keep trying to bring up where they need to bring up the non-rev sports. Make this new hire here and this, you know, this head coach, we can upgrade that facility. We, you know, and it feels a little bit more like things are humming in the midst of chaos.
Yeah. It's a, he was very careful, I thought, to not be like, and we're here now, you know, yes, you can't get up in front, but he also wanted to mark these moments of, you know, look at where we are with these programs and look at what has been accomplished. And look, there's no bigger thing to me than just looking at the revenue numbers. I went and looked it up while we were sitting there because I was waiting to hear the number. Still got a week left. Their fiscal year ends on June 30th. But I was waiting to hear the number because he said last year, he's like, honestly, next year we might get to 200 million. So I wanted to see if the athletic revenues were reaching that level. And he said that they were, that this year is going to be over 200 million when it ends next week. In 2017-18, so his second year as the athletic director, Illinois' revenues were 91 million, and that was 45th nationally. We don't know how the other schools will shake out right now, but wherever the 200 million comes in, last year it would have been 17th or maybe 16th. That's a massive jump. Everybody looks at that number and like, oh, it went up to 200 million. Well, I hear that the Big Ten's making a lot more money now, and so that's probably that. No, Illinois has been playing leapfrog with a ton of programs. You know, some are increasing from that 91 million, and they're maybe at 140 million now. Illinois has gotten from 91 million to 200. It's revenue from, yes, the Big Ten TV deal and all that, but it's also revenue from ticket sales, set a record. iFund last year set a record. Donations, they're going to have another $150 million donation year. Not that number is kind of a different thing, and it goes in different categories. But what they're doing is they have merchandise sales to everything else has skyrocketed, and Illinois is now a top 20 athletic program when it was 45th only 8 years ago. That is a massive change for an athletic department, and that money allows you to do so much more, like assemble rosters that go to the Final Four.
Expenses are also up.
Yes.
They're at record numbers.
But it has to be. I mean, it's a zero-sum game. Everybody's got to zero out their numbers. They can't. they can't like make $40 million in college athletics. You just have to do that. So your expense number is always going to be the same as your revenue number. You know, a little above this year, a little below that year, but it always will be. But $200 million says we are now competing with those teams just a step below your Ohio States and your Alabamas. Like, that's what that number says, and it allows you to do so much more.
So, Josh Whitman, he is our guest for the second time on Light the Eye. We're going to talk with him in just a moment. Anything else from your perspective?
No, I just think it was really interesting that it was a little less, here's how we're building, and a little more, here's what we've built. And he certainly did not have a tone of like, we're there, because he's, you know, he mentioned the next goal for basketball is a national title. The next goal for football is college football playoff.
Right now, Brad Underwood has that can't win in April thing hanging over him.
Yes. So he has said, like, this is next steps and next steps. But the tone, you know, I didn't need to take notes in that first, like, 40 minutes or whatever, because it was very, it was different. Like, last year, I'm just typing notes because he's given stats and figures and this and that, and I want to have them down.
That was your 19-year-old approach? Don't need to take notes?
That's right. That's right. Notes? What are you talking about? What's this letter from the university? But yes, it was a rousing speech to begin it. You know, it was very different, and I enjoyed that. And I was intrigued at how he wanted to take a moment. To, you know, he talked about the shifts and how, you know, two guys have left his departments to take athletic director jobs elsewhere, Tom Moreland and Roger Denny. He talked about how there's been some shifts in coaching staffs and football and other things and all of that. So, yeah, it's a moment of a pivot, if you will. But he did want to mark that, like, these last few years of football, women's basketball, and men's basketball has been a significant step, and they wanted to recognize what they've been.
And he called them images that he wanted to talk about, as opposed to the stats looking back.
Yes.
At the year, you know, it's images that are in his head of the lobby and the hotel for the Final Four.
Yes.
And you know, how the people that were there and how the team was celebrated, and images of send-offs and all these good things. And ironically, poetically, coincidentally, right after the Final Four, he spent several weeks dealing with vision issues, as he shared publicly. So yeah, he was not as visible around campus or at competitions because he had to be recovering from double eye surgery. Mm-hmm. So he got to dwell on the happy images of the last athletic year.
Yep, yep. And we'll talk about that here in a moment.
We're going to talk to Josh Whitman in just a moment, but first a word from one of our sponsors. It's Logic Coworking. It's Champaign's home for co-working, your ideal workspace in a bright and welcoming environment. Members at Logic Coworking can enjoy 24/7 access to best-in-class amenities. You can find your focus in a workspace designed to inspire, connect, and support you. They have offices for rent if you need a semi-permanent or permanent location to work remotely or operate your business. But how about just a membership where you can help yourself to an open desk, a cubicle, a booth, and a conference space if you need. There's also day passes if you just need to get away and have a different environment for a full day of productivity for just the price of lunch. And there's discounts for students. So check out Logic Coworking in Champaign at the corner of Neal and St. Mary's, or online at logic.work. Logic Coworking, supporting Light the Eye. Josh Whitman is here with us on Light the Eye. He just spent some time with us at his annual media roundtable, and now we get to follow up with some one-on-one or two-on-one time. Is it his here on Light the Eye? Josh, we were joking a little bit earlier in the podcast. You're our first two-play of the year.
You're the
first repeat guest. So we just pulled out the scouting report from last time.
I respect that. I respect that.
But I know you've done a lot of talking today, so thank you for giving us some time here today.
My pleasure.
Yeah. And you started your roundtable just by giving us an update. You've been through it there with double eye surgery. So good to see you, and I'm sure it's good for you to be up and seeing everybody. While you were spending a lot of time face down and not being able to do much with your eyes, I can only assume you used the time to listen to podcasts or radio broadcasts.
Oh, you're so funny.
Aren't I?
Yeah.
No, but in all seriousness, glad you're come through that on the other side.
Mostly. I appreciate it. Yeah, thanks. It was unexpected, but really grateful to all the people I heard from, and thanks for all the support that people have showed to me. My wife, first and foremost, but our staff at DIA was incredible, and felt like we were really able to continue to be productive even in the midst of all that.
I feel like we don't want to spend a lot of time talking with you necessarily about the sports that have happened, but I don't want that to just be a casual pass by, because it's just been a very tremendous year. So I think congratulations is in order to you, and I want that to be acknowledged. But we only get so much time at times to talk with you about the other global things that you work on. But when it comes to what fans, you know, are interested in, it's the wins, it's the moments that you talked about, and those shouldn't just be tossed aside. So I do want to express that.
Well, I appreciate that, and it was another great year, and you know, I think the story resonates so much more when you appreciate where it started, and that's something that really fills me with a lot of humility and gratitude, just to know all the people who have been involved in moving this program from where it was to where it is today. And you know, that's the most important thing, is just all the effort that has been required from so many different corners to get us to where we are. And that's what makes it really special.
And another thing that sat with me, as you were talking about the students now that are making memories and connections with the university, we've had student producers. We had Kendall, we had Ellen Mazey through the spring semester. We have Kendall here with us today, and we've gotten to talk with them. Like, they are living it out. Like, they are forming those memories and those connections and things that are going to be bringing them back here for generations. And it's just really cool to see.
It is. It's really, for me, this has always been about the University of Illinois. It's not about the athletic program. It's not about the wins and losses. It's about how can the wins and losses benefit our athletic program so that our athletic program can benefit the university. And the university is benefiting from these students having these incredible experiences, being on Green Street, running to the alma mater, standing in the rain, celebrating these wins, forming these lifelong memories that they'll still cling to 30 years from now, and they'll share those with their friends. It will make them feel connected to this place. And hopefully, on some level, it all comes full circle, and maybe they become donors, maybe they become professors, maybe they send their kids to Illinois. There's a lot of reasons that matters, and it's been really cool now over the last couple of years to be able to see the athletic program fulfilling that part of its mission to help uplift the entire institution.
You know, at the Final Four, we saw so many pictures of former basketball players, former football players, who everybody comes into town for a moment like that. As a former football player yourself, what was that like seeing all these people? I'm sure you had teammates who were like, hey, man, send you a text, like, I'm coming, like, I'm going to be there no matter what. You know, there's the athletic director side, but as the former athlete and as the guy who's worn orange and blue, what was that weekend like?
It was incredible, and I think back to one of the pregame events that we hosted was in a, it was almost like a little house. It was a two stories, a bar, but it was probably the largest single gathering of former athletes we've ever had, and it was packed shoulder to shoulder, first floor, second floor, from every sport. And so obviously you have some basketball players, you've got some football players, but I mean, you had soccer athletes there and golfers and tennis athletes. And it was just such a cool environment to see all those people who made the journey back to Indianapolis, and to watch them reconnecting with their teammates and seeing people they went to class with. It was super powerful. And it filled my heart with a lot of pride just to be able to walk through that building and really, to your point, take my athletic director hat off and be a letter winner. And one of the people who belonged in that building with everybody else was really one of the special memories that I took from that weekend.
And I was curious, so you graduated spring of 2000, right? So were you at all able to attend any of the 01 stuff, like the Elite Eight run that year? Or I guess you were NFL camps and things like that year. So
I was, yeah. So I actually finished classes in December of 2000. Okay. And so then it was the spring of 2001 is when I kind of went full
draft.
Monk approach and, yeah. and just kind of locked myself in my apartment and worked out every day and ate everything I could find and tried to get ready for that experience. And so I was kind of under a rock during most of that. I watched it, of course, but wasn't in a position to get out and participate personally. And so didn't have that memory as a student.
Yeah. Yeah. And then 05, did you attend any of that in St. Louis? And
I did. Yeah. So I just started working in the athletic program in January of 2005. And so it was here as that team made its run and had a chance to participate both as a fan, but then now as an employee.
Sure.
One of my first big jobs, and I was, you know, I was whatever I was, 26 or 27 years old. Warren Hood, who was my boss at the time, we had the opportunity to acquire some additional tickets through, I think maybe it was the St. Louis Sports Commission. And my job was to drive to St. Louis to collect the tickets. And I think I drove back from St. Louis with like $1 million in ticket inventory.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I've got it like sitting in the passenger seat of my car. Great. I'm like white knuckling it, you know, 10-2, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I gotta get these back to Champaign. I mean, it felt like I had a pile of cash.
That's right, but it was
cool, and I did have a chance. I was not regrettably at the Chicago game. I watched that one on television, but I was at the Indianapolis first and second rounds, and then I was at the Final Four.
Yeah, that's great. Go ahead, Scott.
So. One of my takeaways from the roundtable today just seemed, well, first of all, that Illinois Field's getting a renovation, but I promised Robert I wouldn't spend 25 minutes on that topic.
Who
but
cares?
I'm very excited about that.
Good.
It's been a long time coming for the fans. I think it'll be great. But just, I guess, in the midst of what's a tumultuous time in college athletics, and as we've been in this, you've called it an inflection point for several years, but is it fair to say it feels like there's a lot of stability at Illinois and you've got your high-profile sports in a place where they can have sustained success? I know you're not necessarily say we're done, we're a finished product or anything, but it feels like some stability in the midst of chaos.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that, you know, we have viewed the chaotic environment around us as an opportunity, and we have tried to be very disciplined in the way we think about it and talk about it. And I think it's hard to argue during the last 5 years, things have been pretty good for Illinois. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons is I think we've been effective at navigating within this fairly uncharted space. And so we have tried to find places where we could zig where others are zagging, where we could lean into something different than our competitors. One of those things for us has been stability. We have great head coaches. We've had consistent leadership at the university. We have a really well-established, personally connected donor base. And so let's try and take advantage of that and ride this horse. And so it's been really productive for us and a great time, by the way, for Illinois to be good. It would be really hard in this environment if we weren't good right now. If we were struggling to fill the stadium, we're struggling to bring people into the building, we're struggling to gain attention, to win games. I think it'd be really hard to flip a program in this environment, but I think we're in a position now to really punch the gas, and that's where we want to be. And I'm really happy that you know, we went through the first 5 or 6 years of this experience to get us to this point, and it timed up really well with kind of the onset of some of the environmental change that has been around us for the last 4 or 5 years.
And because of that, does that allow you now, is it like, I don't know, a next phase when it comes to non-rev sports or Olympic sports? We can start to address this facility. You know, you've made some coaching changes. We're going to look at, you know, you said today you're going to explore a practice space for volleyball and wrestling. So there's kind of those things. And at the same time, you're addressing national issues on the D1 council and however else you might be involved in the conversations.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we're always assessing everything. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in continual evaluation of every part of our program. And a lot of it has to do with opportunities and needs that intersect. And so if we have a a donor who steps forward who has a particular passion for a project, and we have a need to do that project, and that project sometimes gets pushed to the front of the line. I think sometimes people believe that, you know, we go out and influence donors to say, hey, you really want to give your money to this. The reality is, to be a good fundraiser, you just have to be a really effective listener. And we don't often push people towards a project that doesn't resonate with them on a personal level. And we just try and listen and match people to opportunities. And so it's been just continuing to iterate on that idea. It's not, okay, now we're at a point where we can pay attention to this sport or that sport. It's just there, as we've been able to check some of these other boxes, then it puts us in a position to be able to broaden our aperture a bit and look at some of the other things that are connected to the program.
The last time you were here, we talked about this subject and I brought it up. Today you were able to say that, you know, this fiscal year ends Tuesday or whatever, and you don't have the final numbers, but it's likely to be over $200 million for the first time in athletic revenue. That made me go back and look up the numbers. I found a chart from 2017-18 school year that said the revenue was $91 million at the time, and that was 45th in athletic revenue at the time. Last year, there were only 16 teams over $200 million. I don't know what it will come out to this year. But that growth up that chart from 45th in revenue to top 20 probably now in revenue, tell me what that does for the program, what that advances for, what that gives you the ability to do when you raise all of those, you know, ticket sales are up, merchandise is up, TV stuff is up, everything else.
Well, I think it just continues to give us the tools that we need to compete at the highest level. And we have worked incredibly hard, spent a lot of time, a lot of money to get our program to where it is today. And now the challenge for us is to sustain it, to continue to elevate it. To do that, we need resources. And I think sometimes the message in the public gets distorted. There's this, I think, misunderstanding that people in college athletics were, quote unquote, all about the money. Mm-hmm. People never take the next step and say, well, why do we want the money? We want the money because it helps us win. And the charge that has been placed upon us is to win at the highest level. And so the best way for us to do that is to match up incredible leadership with exceptional resources. And so we've got great leaders in place. Now it's my job, our job, to make sure that we're able to support them with the resources they need. And whether we like it or not, the hill is getting steeper. The competitive environment is getting harder. And so we have to continue to find ways to generate more money. That has to be a driving force for us as we come into the office every day. And honestly, even with the arrival of Tom Michael and somebody who has such incredible experience as he does, that now allows him to take on more day-to-day operation of the program and allows me and some other people on our staff to focus even more of our attention on revenue generation and how are we going to continue to fuel the engine that has become Illinois athletics, and in particular, you know, football, basketball. And so that's where we're spending a lot of time right now.
I know you talked some about this today at the roundtable, but for our listeners, can you just share kind of a pivot point of two of your staffers left for athletic directors positions, one at the University of Oklahoma, one at the University of Toledo. Just that pivot moment for your staff and what the plans are and who you've moved around and where that is to go forward.
Yeah, sure. It's again, congratulations to both of those guys, Roger and Tom. Just so excited for both of them. Incredible opportunities. Roger, I mentioned today, he's already got two national championships. He's been there for about 5 minutes. So I'm not jealous about that at all, but
no.
Excited for him to bring home the trophy in Omaha this last week. And then Tom to get his chance at Toledo, a really high-level MAC program, and I know he's already doing great things there. But when that happens, of course, you lose some of your institutional knowledge. You lose some of your momentum. It's important that we take quick steps to try and fill those roles and make sure that we're reallocating those responsibilities. And so we were able to bring back in Tom Michael. Tom's a name that, of course, is familiar to most of our fans. has been the athletic director at Eastern Illinois for the last 12 years. And prior to that, worked in various roles with NDIA here in Illinois for 18 years. And so it's really pretty cool for me as a former football player to have a former football player and a former basketball player in the top two spots in the athletic department. I don't know that there's any other program in the country that has that. And so Tom and I have become great friends over the years, and there's a lot of trust. So I'm really grateful to him for wanting to come back on board with us. Brian Russell's a name some people are familiar with. He's become our new chief commercial officer, which is the role that Tom vacated when he went to Toledo. Bobby Busboom is another name that some people will know, originally from St. Joseph, now is our chief hospitality officer, which is the role that Brian was in. So anytime that happens, it gives you a chance to create new opportunities for some people who maybe have been with you for a while and are prepared to take on greater roles. And really excited about Brian and Bobby and everybody else we have in leadership positions within the program.
Well, you may downplay it, but when we had you on last, you were just approaching your 10th anniversary as the AD here, and you reflected a bit on that at the end of your roundtable, and now you have a little bit of an athletic director tree. There's coaching trees, you know. I came out of the spread offense, you know, with this head coach or whatever. So now there's going to be people, I think, that will say I came out of the Whitman tree, but maybe you don't want to own that, but I think it's true.
I think we're going to need more than a couple branches before we can call it a tree. That would be exciting. And we have a lot of really talented people in DIA, and I don't believe that Tom leaving will be the last person to go off and have an athletics director opportunity. I fully expect that to happen with more frequency as we go forward, not less. And again, I think it's a testament to the people that we bring in. We bring people here who have high aspirations and who have an incredible skill set. I don't expect them necessarily to spend the rest of their careers here, although if they want to, that would be great. But they're going to come in, they're going to make a big difference for us, they're going to teach us things, and then they're going to move on to whatever the next opportunity is. And Tom Marlin's a great example. Tom was only here 3 years, but during his 3 years, we reworked almost everything we do from a revenue perspective, and he taught us how to do that. And now we're the beneficiaries of that information, that knowledge, and we have the ability to continue to build on it going forward.
All right, a big issue out there nationally is the Protect College Sports Act that is out there. And you spoke passionately when this topic came up in your address to us, and particularly because there's narratives that are out there that it seemed like you felt you were important. It felt important to you to for people to understand your perspective. Could you share a little bit of that, particularly as it comes to how some people at least, are talking about the Big Ten and the SEC in this world?
Yeah, I think, so we have a bill. It's been introduced with bipartisan sponsorship in the Senate, which is a big deal. And we are grateful to those senators for taking an active interest in college athletics. My frustration is that the Big Ten and the SEC have not been a prominent part of helping to construct that bill. And I know that there have been other people, other influences who don't sit on the inside of college athletics who are exerting tremendous influence over where that bill is headed. And that to me feels a little bit misaligned. So I grow frustrated because I think to serve that constituency, there has been built this narrative that the Big Ten and the SEC are quote unquote the bad guys. And I don't believe that. I have the opportunity to be in the room with the athletic directors from the Big Ten every week. We have worked closely with the athletic directors in the SEC. I've done this now for a decade. I've gotten to know all of the people involved in this business. These are good-hearted, well-intentioned people. We have 14,000 student athletes in the Big Ten who are getting a world-class, life-changing experience. I think we know a little bit about college athletics and how to do it at a high level. So I'm hopeful that we are invited to engage a bit more for the rest of the process than we were in the first part of the process. I think that would be productive. We want to be supportive of the bill. The bill is much more detailed than some of the prior bills that we have seen. which is good on one hand if we can get it passed, but it's challenging in the sense that we're now committing to federal law things that previously had been put into NCAA bylaws. And so if we want to do that, then we better make sure that it's good law, because to change it is going to be really, really hard.
It would take an act of Congress.
It literally will take an act of Congress. And so getting it across the finish line in the first place will be difficult, but if we want to make any substantive changes going forward, that'll be even harder.
I want to ask about that, and apologies if this is a question you can't really answer, but there's this, I'll just give you my view and I'll let you react to it. I think some of the demonizing of the Big Ten and SEC have come from Big 12 and ACC voices. We'll just leave it at that. Yet the four conferences need to work together in some way. There's an imbalance there, mostly because of eyeballs, I'll just say it that way. Like, there's more revenue in the SEC and the Big Ten because the TV contracts are much bigger, because there's more fan interest than maybe some other parts of the country in college football and everything else. And that imbalance has existed for a while. And there's a feeling that some of this legislation is moving toward let's set it up so that the conferences that aren't making as much are on equal footing kind of thing. So there's two things working against each other. There's one, the conferences are all trying to, you know, work together and to find something, but there is this imbalance, and that imbalance exists because of, it's an advantage for the Big Ten and the SEC schools. How does that get sorted out is my question. Like, how do you get to where I'm 2/3, you're 1/3 kind of a thing, but let's all meet in the middle and here's all of our interests? I mean, it just seems like such a mess of things. And as you've said, this is our moment of incredible self-interest in college sports. And so you have these teams who are looking at this legislation of saying like, hey, maybe this is our opportunity to get some things to knock the Big Ten and the SEC down, and they treat it as some kind of a weapon. So given that, I don't know how much of that you can react to, like how do we work through that mess?
I don't know is the short answer. And I think you have accurately assessed the environment. I think there are a lot of situations where our four conferences are very aligned and where we continue to work together and collaborate well. I think there are places where that has become increasingly difficult, in how do we politically and otherwise navigate in those areas is yet to be determined. And so some of these, and they're not all, I don't mean to suggest, because there are a lot of outside influences, I think, involved in this process. I think it'd be an interesting story if somebody really wanted to do some investigative journalism to really follow where the levers are being pulled. But I think that, you know, there is an interest here from whatever those stakeholders are in seeing a leveling of the playing field. And they're looking for ways to accomplish that. Some of them are tied into the bill. Some of them maybe are ancillary to the bill. But I think there's a growing acknowledgement of the revenue gap, and it's putting a lot of pressure on the schools that are in conferences other than the Big Ten and the SEC to try and find ways to close it. And so that creates a lot of incentive for these outside forces to try and insert themselves and in some ways potentially even artificially manipulate the system to level the playing field. And that's, you know, the federal government is one of those places where that can happen. So it's been fascinating to watch this unfold. It would be less frustrating if I weren't right in the middle of all
sure.
of it. But if I were just on the outside observing it, it would be an incredible study. But I can't predict how it will resolve.
And at the same time, again, this is just my observation. I told a friend the other day that my comparison for this is the real ID thing, where like it was going to be like 2019, everybody has to have a real ID to get on. And then, okay, COVID, we push off to 2021. And it wasn't until like 2025, they just kept getting kicked down the line. Like, okay, well, we won't do this, we'll do this. I have that same perception of college athletics right now, with even with enforcing the house things and all the other stuff. It's like, well, let's just wait another year. Well, let's just kick it down the road. Let's just keep doing this. We don't need the rules yet, do we? You know, like there's no motivation to like do, to change. It's like, well, let's just wait. Let's just, we'll figure this out. And while you wait, they figure out ways around and loopholes and everything else. How in that environment can something come together? Is it just legislation is the lever that needs to be pulled? How do we get there?
I don't know that it's the only lever, but it's certainly the most readily apparent lever. Because what you have is, if you've got everybody agreeing to a new system, it will work. If you have nobody agreeing to a new system, that also could potentially work.
Mm-hmm.
What doesn't work is when you have some people agreeing to the new system and other people not.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden you have people playing by different rules. And that's really hard to sustain. And because the competitive pressures are such that everybody eventually moves back over to the side without the rules. And so there's got to be some collective decision that either we come to by ourselves or that we're forced to come to, that we're going to adopt and fully comply with some new system. And whether that's the College Sports Commission or some subsequent iteration, I don't know. But at some point, there's going to have to be some external governor on our spending. It's the only way this works, because right now, every incentive is there for us to spend every new dollar that we get to try and win more games. We talked about the selfish moment that we're all living in. Like, the competitive pressures are real, and those have been created for us. If we don't win at a certain level, everybody, myself included, will get fired. And so we know that we have a certain fuse, and before it runs out, we better perform at a certain level. And so if I can go out and raise another $100, and that $100 is going to help increase our chances of winning on Saturday by just that much, I'm going to go find that $100. And then 100 becomes 1,000, 1,000 becomes 100,000, 100,000 becomes 1,000,000. And so before you know it, we're in this place where we're all just finding as much money as we can to dump it into our program as fast as we can so that we can win as quickly as we can. And the only way to solve for that is some cost control. And it's just a function of how does that happen. And I think, you know, the other part that's worth noting is we can all take our shots at the College Sports Commission and this new environment. I don't think we've spent enough time acknowledging how important this first step has been. Like, we are now directly paying student athletes.
Yeah.
Huge step. Operationally and philosophically, probably the most important step, right? We can't do anything else until we cross the bridge on this first thing, that we agree we're now going to begin paying athletes. Well, everything else, I really do believe, will work its way out. Like, how and when and how much and for what, that's all yet to be figured out. But we can't do any of those things until we get to this first place, which is, hey, by the way, we're now paying athletes. That's a big deal. And so, you know, we've got to continue to figure out ways to answer some of those follow-up questions. And eventually there's going to have to be some external governor on how much we can spend. And the question is, where is that going to come from, and in what shape is it going to take?
Let me ask one more follow-up on that. In that structure that you just discussed, when you have schools, if you had four conferences with identical revenue, a solution there can start to, you can start to see the solution there. When you don't have that, the conferences with less just revenues coming in from the conference, from the TV deals and everything else, are going to say, hey, we don't really want that. To stay competitive here, we can't have those regulations because you have the money to do that. We don't. And if it's capped, and if there's some governor on this, we're in trouble. How is that solved? I've thought about it a lot. I can't come up with a solution. I'm glad I'm not in charge, but how can that be solved?
It's a great question. And you're spot on. The challenge is, if we want to have a cap, every cap is going to make sense for some schools and it's not going to make sense for others. Either the cap is going to be too high, so the lower resource schools are going to feel disadvantaged, or the cap is going to be too low, so the higher resource schools are going to feel like they can't maximize the benefit of their resources. And so trying to find that sweet spot is the challenge. And I don't know exactly how we're going to resolve that yet. I do think one possibility is that we look at an environment where each conference manages its own situation, and we say, okay, well, the Big Ten's going to step out. We're going to set a cap for the Big Ten schools. And the SEC is going to step out, and they're going to set a cap for their schools. And the ACC is going to do the same, and the Big 12 is going to do the same. And then at the end of the year, we're all going to agree to spit out our best teams, and we're going to go play a championship. And we're going to accept that maybe the SEC's cap is 10% higher than the Big Ten's, and the Big Ten's is 20% higher than the ACC's. And that's going to be okay, because at the end, we're still going to go play. We're going to go play a championship. And I think, and I'm obviously, the World Cup is underway. I'm no aficionado on international soccer. But the bit that I have read and the studying that I have done, I believe there are some models like that overseas, where they have leagues that have their own rules, and then at the end of different points in time, they'll send forth their best teams to go play in some sort of overarching competition. Sure. And so there are examples globally of situations where that works, and it maybe that's a short-term solution to bridging the gap to a more national approach, but it may become a necessary short-term solution, I think, to your point, to do something that's right size for each of those conferences, knowing that what that is going to be different.
Yeah.
Another item you mentioned in the roundtable, and it is a headline this week, 5 for 5 in eligibility. The council passed it. Is there, just for clarity, is there another step to it? It's done deal. It is happening.
It's a done deal.
This is, yep. At least going forward, looks like there may be some challenges about retroactive, but going forward, everybody gets a clock starting when they're 19, and you get 5 years to play 5 seasons. No more redshirting, no more waivers. If you play 5 years, great. If you only get to play one because of injury or you got benched or whatever, that's the way it works. And you said transformative, this moment here, and I don't want to just pass over that, because I thought that was a significant word that you used.
It is, and I mentioned this morning that the cabinet, the group that I work with, that passed this legislation. It used to be the council. Oh, it's easy to, you got to have a playbook or a scorecard to keep track of all these things. But occasionally we do some pretty mundane things, right? Everything we pass is not the most riveting. But every once in a while, something comes across the desk, and you're like, wow, this is a big deal. You know, occasionally we get to create a new championship, right? Like, hey, we just created the women's wrestling championship. Like, that's a big freaking deal. Now we got a chance to pass this piece of legislation that will reshape college eligibility for decades to come, presumably. And I think it just makes so much sense, the predictability of the system. Systems have to be predictable. You have to have a sense of, this is how it's going to work. I know how many years you have, so I can plan for other athletes and other. It just alleviates a lot of the subjectivity and the inconsistency that I think was inevitable in the old system. And nobody was out doing it on purpose. It just, because of the various situations that would present themselves, it was really hard to bring a consistent approach. And this makes it much simpler, much cleaner, easier to understand. And I think it's awesome for our student athletes, because most of them, there are exceptions. There's 400 some odd thousand student athletes in the country. There are people who need 6 years or 7 years because every football team's got a guy who's had 3 ACLs, you know.
Right.
But for most athletes, they're getting 4 years. And so the trade-off was, hey, we're gonna take a little bit away from that small handful of student athletes who are playing 6 and 7 years, but we're going to give something to 95% of the student athletes, and we're going to give them another year. And that's a pretty awesome opportunity. And so we feel really good about it. Again, there will be some growing pains. There will be some transitional elements here that we have to work through. But pretty amazing that student athletes now can stay for that extra year and get the benefit of being on a college campus and continuing your education and getting the chance to play high-level sports at the same time.
One question about that. What nomenclature was used for the cabinet for the fifth? Is it just fifth year? I've been thinking about this. We have used freshman, sophomore, junior, senior.
Yeah.
In colleges and in everything else. Huh. Now, when you see, you know, a thing on the screen says Luke Altmaier, senior quarterback, Illinois. Senior still means he's got another year of eligibility. Was it talked about like, what do we call, do we add a year before freshman? Or do we say fifth year on the end? How is that?
Great question.
Yeah. It could be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Well, we
could be.
We've talked about different things. Two things. One, it's a subtle point, but an important point. It's not 5 for 5. So you'll never hear it referred to that. It's an age based eligibility model.
Okay.
And it's centered on a 5-year experience. But in terms of how we refer to it, we actually had that conversation with our staff the other day. We never talked about it at the NCAA, mm-hmm. but just institutionally on our rosters, on the website, like how do you catalog people? And we talked about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We felt like that would be too professional and we wanted to just maintain the collegiate connection. And so I think what we're going to do is freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, fifth year, mm-hmm. knowing that fifth year could be any selection of things. They could be a graduate student. They could be working on a second bachelor's. They could be doing a lot of different things academically. And so we thought that fifth year would be more general.
As someone who had to go 5 years because of academic preparation, I've used the term victory lap before I did 4 years and then a victory lap. Can I nominate victory lap? So
noted.
Freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, victory. Yeah. There. You're chair of the cabinet, so you can put that in. Great.
Just call it a Robert ear.
Yes, that's right.
Right. That's right.
Love it.
Within the last 2 years, you've been made a number of head coaching hires, some by circumstance, some by your choice, some by the coach's choice. What's your reflection on that? Three recent hires. And just that the process for you after a lot of a lot less turnover, I guess I would say, in the years before that.
Well, I think, you know, we pretty consistently are hiring 1 to 2 head coaches a year. It's rare when we have a year where we don't make any head coaching hires. And so this year was 3, a little bit higher than normal. We'd done as many as 4. We did 4, I think, a couple years back. But for us, it's always an opportunity. We always see transition as an opportunity, no matter what the circumstances were that prompted the transition. Evan Clark left as the winningest coach in women's tennis history. We still see that transition as an opportunity. And so as we get into those processes, we always start with the same place, which is, let's develop a profile for the person that we want. What are the characteristics? I learned that early in my career. We're not going to chase names. We're going to chase a profile. We're going to chase characteristics. Because I think sometimes you can get infatuated with a name or a background. And if it doesn't actually align with the things that you think are most important, you may end up making a bad decision. And so we put characteristics on a piece of paper. We start to identify a list. We vet that list against those characteristics. The great thing is, in this day and age, with computers, you can do a lot of research without ever having to even talk to another person. You can, all these folks, if they've been involved in athletics at any level, most of the time we're going to have a pretty extensive YouTube catalog. You can get on and watch them do interviews like this, and then they go on a podcast. You can watch the way they talk about their team, post-game things that they do, any of the mic'd-up stuff that programs do now through their social media. You can learn a lot about these folks just by doing some internet sleuthing. And that's really become helpful. And then we move into conversations. We start to talk to folks. You know, what I don't do is I don't ask about, and I think a lot of people probably assume I do, like I don't ask about scheme or, you know, X's and O's of their respective sports. Like, I just assume that if I'm having a conversation with them, A, that means they've been pretty successful. and B, that must mean they know a lot about their sport. And so I'm much more interested in who they are as a person, how they're going to fit here within the culture that we've built, what their motivation is, what their motor is. I think the other thing that we have learned, having done this for a long time, is that even at a place like Illinois, there are differing levels of competitor. And we want to find people who are kind of that next level of competitor. Because the reality is, being a head coach at Illinois is a very self-managed experience, right? Like, I don't stand at the back door every day and check people in. I don't look to see when they're leaving. I don't check their expense reports to see how much they're traveling or what they're, who they're recruiting. They have a lot of autonomy, and we need people who are going to thrive with that autonomy, who are going to look to, you know, when they're watching TV at night, I don't know if anybody still watches commercials, but when the commercial comes on, they're going to grab their phone, they're going to shoot off 3 text messages to recruits, you know, or they're going to be the ones who are up early trying to, you know, get on an airplane to go see somebody, or they're going to meet a pitcher to work on this, or they're going to, you know, meet up with a goalkeeper to work on this other thing. Like, there's another level of commitment, and we work really hard to try and find people who have that inner drive, and it's hard to find. It's rare. And if you can find people who have that desire, that drive, and you can match it with leadership characteristics, humility, and appreciation for this place, then you're really starting to cook with something. And that's where I spend the bulk of my time in these processes, is trying to really parse out those characteristics.
Switching back to, you know, focus on campus, this season, of any season I've covered or been around, even as a student or anything else, had more like memorable images that I can remember. I mean, you have the snow game, obviously, and you've got the players on a pile of snow after winning the hat. And you've got smashing a guitar in Nashville and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But like, just these snapshots of the Marching Illini on Broadway in Nashville, New Year's Eve, you know, doing the concert the night before with everybody hanging out these 5-story bars above and this and that. Like, it just, and then obviously everything at the Final Four, it just felt like this year of, you know, I know you don't ever want to say like, okay, we're here, now we have attained it. But like, was there recognition of just so many moments this year? What does that mean to you personally? Like, there were so many moments throughout this whole year.
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe it coincided with my 10th anniversary. It coincided with me laying down without being able to see for a month. You know, I had a lot of time to think about it.
Sure.
It was a pretty powerful year, and I think you're right. And of course, I did this in my roundtable. Just the year really is kind of distilled down into images in my mind, and there were just so many very vivid moments where it was making an indelible impression on me. And I think it's nice to hear from other people that they had similar experiences. Like, holy cow, look around! You know, there's the snow game. Like, what an incredible moment that was. Like, that will always be something that I remember, that the bowl game experience, that, like you said, that Broadway and the band and then everything connected to the Final Four, but even in Houston, I mean, there just were so many distinct memories, and you know, it was just such a, I mentioned this earlier, it, I think it helps you appreciate where we are so much more, knowing where we started, and to reflect back on 10 years ago, 9 years ago, 8 years ago, kind of the dearth of those memories. And maybe it's because I've just gotten older and I've forgotten some of them. I'm sure there were memorable moments. It's not to say that there was nothing worth remembering, but there certainly weren't the frequency of them and maybe the staying power of them. And they were moments that in that moment felt very powerful, but now in hindsight, they pale in comparison to some of the things that we're experiencing now. And so just to be able to see that, experience it. And I think, you know, that the biggest emotion I feel day to day is one of intense responsibility. And so to be able to just sort of step back and watch other people celebrating this program, that's the most rewarding thing I can have. And so even like if you would put a camera on me at the Final Four, or I'm sorry, at Houston when we won the regional, if same thing at the bowl game, like I'm not like immediately sprinting out to the middle and jumping on the top of the dog pile. You know, it's I kind of step back and I just watch. And it just means a lot to be able to see all these people who are so passionate about this program, who've put so much into it, enjoying those moments. And you know, that's been, for me anyway, the most rewarding part of this, is knowing that I've had some small part in delivering those memories to these people, whether it be our student athletes, our coaches, our fans, our donors, the list is long. That's the really the lasting memory that I take away.
Yeah.
Great note to end on. Josh, thank you for affording us your time.
I appreciate it.
You're welcome back for a third time.
I will come. I don't know when, but I will come.
You got it.
Thank you both for your coverage. I appreciate it. Thank you a lot.
Thank you so much for Josh Whitman joining us here on the podcast. I honestly thought, here's how this, he talks for a considerable amount of time in his annual roundtable, and then takes a break and then fields questions for another, feels like an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Then he does post-media interviews with various outlets, including us, and he spent a good chunk of time. So, you know, I personally feel grateful, and I know you do too, but ultimately he is doing that for you who are listening and watching us right now, because he knows you care about the Illini and what's happening in the programs. So, you know, just know that that's part of what he's doing there.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't know how he organizes his thoughts so well. He's been talking to answering questions for 5 hours now, right? And he's still on top of things. And this is, his brain is quite impressive to organize his thoughts and to answer so many questions. And to, again, he has so many jobs. He's chair of the D1 cabinet. He's like essentially the most important athletic director in the country in that sense. And, you know, he's talking about calls every week with Big Ten coaches, Big Ten athletic directors, everything else. I don't know how he does it. It's mighty impressive.
And he's doing this, again, he zags when other people zig. Just case in point, there's just not a lot of athletic directors that hang around for 10 plus years. It's just not the nature of college sports.
Michigan State is going on there. So they've had 3 actual presidents and 3 interims in 6 years. And they are now looking for their 4th athletic director in 7 years, something like that. It's, yes, all the time, Illinois has had the same president and the same athletic director.
Okay. We've talked about the parallels between Josh Whitman and the actor John Hamm.
Yes. The voice sounds the same. Close your eyes. Which guy is it?
Yep. And that John Hamm's character on the show Mad Men, which you are appreciative of that show especially, is named Don Draper, but the character's real name is Dick Whitman.
Yes.
Okay. And one of the most famous scenes, especially from early in Mad Men, is Don Draper's pitch to Kodak about what to call
the carousel,
the circle of slides. Remember the old slide projector? Really got to explain to Kendall what that is.
Yes, that's right.
And he comes up, he has this moving pitch to call it the carousel as he's snapping through images of somebody's life. So as Josh was closing with us there, I need you to like AI this and get it like superimpose the carousel and Josh just flipping through Brad Underwood cutting down a net, you know,
a football player's on a pile of snow.
Yeah.
Just, Tommy smashing a guitar
as he, it's his carousel of Illinois athletics.
It's not called a wheel. It's called a carousel.
Yeah. So that's your task. Go AI okay. this up.
I'll go work on that right now. I'll see what I come up with.
But the theme was images of yes. 25 to 26. And there's a lot of like, snap that for a moment here and save it in your memory bank.
That was what was so moving about what he said in his roundtable soliloquy that he shared was, and that's why I should have referenced that when I was sharing the image, because it was how this season played out. And we just got it this week of images of Keaton Wagler at the NBA draft on ESPN and ABC hugging Brad Underwood on national TV when he's picked fifth. It's what a year.
Next time on Light the Eye, it'll be Wimbledon week starting in a few days, so it'll be an opportunity for us to visit with Illinois men's tennis coach Brad Dancer, one of my favorite coaches to talk to just about anything, let alone tennis, because he's been at Illinois for a long time and he's been at this community for a long time. So we will look forward to that. Thanks to our producer, Kendall Crawford, with an assist from Sean Mills here at the Center for Innovation in Teaching and Learning inside the Armory at the University of Illinois. Thanks to our sponsor, Logic Coworking, and of course, the U of I Credit Union. And thanks to Josh Whitman. For Robert Rosenthal, I'm Scott Beatty. We'll talk to you again next time when we light the eye.